The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, my friends. It's Sarah here, back with another episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. It is wonderful to be back with you for this, the second part in a two-part series that focuses on the life and, more specifically, the death and burial of Arthur Tudor, Prince of Wales, who was buried in Worcester Cathedral on the 25th of April, 1502. Now, before then, I just have one announcement that I would like to make, and that is to let all you time travellers out there know that as of the moment that I am releasing this podcast, you will find that our latest tour over on Simply Tudor Tours has been open to booking, and that is Mary, Queen of Scots, From Crown to Captivity. Yes, my friends, we are going to be following in the very dramatic and indeed tragic tale of the beautiful Scots Queen, from the moment of her birth at Linlithgow Palace to her forced abdication on the island of Loch Leven. It is indeed a dramatic tale, isn't it? And there are some fabulous places to visit associated with this period in her life, from indeed Linlithgow Palace through to Stirling Castle, Edinburgh Castle, Holyrood Palace, Craigmillar Castles, Falkland Palace, the wonderful Renaissance Pleasure Palace that Mary loved so much, to indeed Loch Leven, where she miscarried of twins and was ultimately forced to abdicate her throne in favour of her infant son. We'll be joined by some incredible experts along the way, including our headline speaker, Linda Porter, who of course wrote a biography about Mary, Queen of Scots, Crown of Thistles, but also some fabulous historians along the way. We'll have an expert in Mary's life who will be joining us for the entire week, and then meeting folks such as Anna Groundwater, who is the chief curator at the Museum of Scotland, where we will be getting up close and personal with some incredible artifacts associated with Mary and her reign. Well, it's going to be a joyful week for anybody who loves Mary, Queen of Scots and Scottish Renaissance history. It will be a must. So if you are interested in finding out more about the tour, then head over to our tour page over on simplytudortours.com, and I will, of course, put a link in the description associated with this podcast, as ever. Okay, well, that is it. No more announcements. If you have any questions about the tour, of course, you can also email me at sarah@thetudortravelguide.com, and I will be happy to help. But for now, we must turn our attention back to the subject of today's podcast. So let me introduce myself, first of all, because in this instance, I recorded a short intro to this particular episode, having arrived in Worcester on my way to the cathedral. I decided to talk a little bit about the place that is almost the sandwich between Ludlow Castle and Worcester Cathedral, the place where Arthur's body rested overnight, a significant place, before being conveyed to its final resting place at Worcester. So my friends, let's get right on with today's show.
Welcome, dear listeners, to part two of a two-part series in which we have been exploring the death and burial of Arthur Tudor, Prince of Wales. Now, if you remember, in part one, we were at Ludlow Castle in Shropshire, Ludlow Castle, of course, being the location of the Council of the Marches, a place that Arthur had spent a considerable amount of time during his childhood years learning the art of kingship. After his marriage to Catherine of Aragon in November 1501, the young couple headed off back to Ludlow, and it was tragically there, just a few months later, on the 2nd of April 1502, that the pair fell ill, probably with some acute infectious disease, which of course took Prince Arthur to his grave. Now again, if you remember, at the end of the last episode, we visited the Church of St. Lawrence in the little town of Ludlow. This was where Arthur's body was taken to following his death at the castle. We heard about how he lay in state and solemn masses were heard before his heart and entrails were buried close to the high altar. And from there, his body was taken on its onward journey towards Worcester. And that's where I am today, dear friends. I am visiting the city of Worcester, the county capital of Worcestershire, and in particular, Worcester Cathedral, which of course is the final resting place for Prince Arthur. But before we meet our guides for today, I wanted to fill in the gap between what happened to Arthur's body as it left Ludlow and before it arrived at Worcester. After his body left Ludlow, it was placed on a cart which needed to be drawn by oxen, so foul was the weather at the time. And the sorry party, along with all the mourners, made their way to the Palace of Tickenhill. I wanted to put Tickenhill in the spotlight because it's a place that not many people have heard of. It actually came into the possession of the crown during the reign of Edward IV, who inherited it from his Mortimer ancestors. And when Henry VII took the crown from the Yorkists, he ploughed a considerable amount of money into the palace because he intended it to be one of the principal residences of the Council of the Marches alongside Ludlow. We must remember that the Council of the Marches, just like the royal court, was itinerant and spent different seasons in different places. So Tickenhill, when Arthur knew it, was a single courtyard, timber-framed manor house. Thankfully, we know a considerable amount about Tickenhill Palace from inventories that were taken there and also some really important events that took place in Arthur's life. First of all, during much happier times, on the 19th of May, 1499, Prince Arthur was married by proxy to Catherine of Aragon in the very chapel at Tickenhill. And there's a detailed account. And in fact, if you want to read more, I'll make sure I include a link to the blog that I wrote on Tickenhill in the description associated with this podcast. You'll learn much more about the palace and indeed that particular ceremony. And then, after Arthur was married to Catherine of Aragon at St Paul's Cathedral in London, the pair left London heading towards Ludlow. They actually came to Tickenhill and spent their first Christmas together. So two very happy events in Arthur's life. Unfortunately, of course, the third notable one was when Arthur's body was brought back to Tickenhill and rested in the very chapel in which he had been married by proxy to Catherine of Aragon. We know that a solemn requiem mass was heard, the body resting there overnight before it was loaded up again onto a cart and carried on its solemn journey towards Worcester. And in fact, that is where we pick up the story today. In a moment, we'll be heading into the cathedral to meet our guides for today. You'll be learning more about the history of the cathedral, about what happened during Arthur's funeral, and of course, about the wonderful Chantry Chapel, which you can still visit today, where Arthur's body lies in rest. So, with that, why don't we just head on inside and meet our expert guides for today? So you might be able to hear from the acoustics that I've come in from the outside. I'm now inside the West End of Worcester Cathedral. I'm standing with one of our guides today, our cup runneth over. We have two or three people who are going to be contributing to this discussion and exploration about the funeral, the burial and the Chantry Chapel belonging to Prince Arthur. And I'm standing here with David Morrison. Hello.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Well, I've got such happy memories of being here in the past when... Well, why don't you just explain what you do and then I'll tell my little story about our previous meeting.
So I work in the Cathedral Library and we look after many of the ancient books and documents and manuscripts that belong to the cathedral.
Ah, you do as what you do indeed. And in fact, I can't remember when it was now, about a year and a half ago, we arranged to come to Worcester, dear listeners, and David was kind enough. He totally blew us away. There was me and Natalie from Talking Tudors and Deborah from Tudor Places. And we came to look at some of the books and the artefacts you had. And you'd just gone above and beyond. And there was so much for us to look at. We were so excited. I think we got a little bit giddy that day, didn't we? Yeah, David's keeping a polite silence on that. Anyway, can't thank you enough. And in fact, we're going to be back with our tour group in July 2026 when we do the 1500 tour, year that shook the Tudor throne. We'll be visiting Worcester to come and see Prince Arthur's tomb and also to come and look at your beautiful library and some of the documents.
Oh, thank
you. So if you sign up for that tour, you'll be meeting David in person. But we are here today to talk about Arthur, Prince Arthur, and as the listeners will know, we have been to Ludlow Castle, we've spoken about Tickenhill, and we're finally arriving here at Worcester. So let's talk about the funeral in a moment, but first of all, maybe a little bit about Worcester. Can you just place Worcester geographically for people, and why was Arthur brought here? Why on earth didn't he go to London for his funeral?
Yes, so Worcester Cathedral is located in the centre of England and with very close to Birmingham, which is the second city. But Arthur was brought here because King John was already buried here. And so there was precedent for a royal funeral. And it was also very close to Ludlow, one of the nearest cathedrals. The other option might have been Hereford, perhaps, Hereford Cathedral. But because of King John being buried here, it seemed the most sensible.
Ah, right. But yeah, of course, that makes a lot of sense. He's brought here on what day does he arrive at Worcester and how does he arrive here? My understanding is that he was probably, rather than coming overland, because the weather was awful, wasn't it, at the time?
It was.
The River Severn, we're standing right next to the west doors, which would have been the main doors back in the day?
I believe they would have been, yes. The main entrance for processions and major events. Yeah. You would make sure that people came through this door.
Because you've got this fantastic view, haven't you, right down the nave towards the high altar. So perfect for such a magnificent occasion.
Ideal. With a sort of a 14th century pillars and the huge 14th century ceiling as well, it really sort of would have set the scene with the hundreds of candles and the procession coming in here.
Oh, God, it's just gives me all the shiver. And in fact, you know, I shouldn't run ahead of myself. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the cathedral, when it was founded, who it was founded by, and any other notable facts about the cathedral itself that is worth knowing about?
Worcester Cathedral was founded in 680 AD, and it was a major Anglo-Saxon cathedral, and it had a monastery from about the 950s or 960s, went alongside the cathedral itself. It was rebuilt several times over the centuries, and the cathedral that we see now, with its 14th century nave, would have been what the funeral cortege would have seen when they came in.
It's a really beautiful cathedral. I know I say this a lot. People who listen to me will hear me say, oh, it's one of my favourites. But I think in terms of cathedrals, it is, because it's got such a beautiful blend of architecture. And then you've got the history of King John being buried here. And also, of course, you've got this fantastic Tudor tomb, Chantry Chapel, which we'll be going to see and exploring.
Absolutely.
In a moment. So I'm thinking he was brought downstream from Bewdley. Would you agree? Is there any confirmation of that? Do we know that for sure, or is this just Guesswork.
We think he was brought over land, and at least two of the king's officials who were in charge of the funeral came to the city in advance to make sure that this was, you know, nobody came in advance who was perhaps a guest. Everyone had to wait until the cortege had arrived. So,
oh, really?
So that was the our understanding of what happened.
Okay. So do you think he would have been brought through these west doors here?
I think that was extremely likely. It would have been the main ceremonial entrance.
Yeah. So when the funeral cortege arrived here, this was probably about 3 weeks or so after Arthur died at
yes.
Ludlow on the 2nd of April. Why the delay? Because people do sometimes ask that. It's quite, you know, it's quite a long delay often of these royal burials. Why was that the case?
I think to get all the preparations ready and to make it suitable and regal for a prince, there's a lot they have to do and get ready in time and make sure all the bishops and abbots who are going to be attending, all the noblemen, can make it to Worcester in time.
Yeah.
So I think, and plus they've got to embalm the body, so there's a huge amount for them to do.
Yeah, lots to do. And what do we know of the funeral here at Worcester? What records exist to tell us what happened that day?
Well, surprisingly, there's no actual records of the funeral in the cathedral archives itself, even though the monastery would have hosted the funeral. So there's only a handful of references in the monastic accounts to the construction of the chantry later on. So any record is a national record of what happened.
It's surprising, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do we have any details? And even if, obviously, as you're saying, you've got no records held here, are there any details of things like the numbers of people attending or who was the chief mourner, who held the ceremony?
That's right. So we know that there were several hundred candles were purchased for the funeral itself. There's the huge pall that goes out with the coffin and the sort of the I won't say chariot, but it's more than that. It's sort of a significant construction to carry the coffin with all the noblemen around it. And then once you get here to Worcester, the Earl of Surrey is the principal mourner on representing the royal family. And then you have Sir William Overdale, who was the head of Arthur's household, who's charged with organising the whole funeral process itself as well.
All right, OK. And how many guests do we know? I presume the cathedral would have been full to capacity.
I think so. They've at least, I think it's 400 or 500 people are known to have attended. So then there were probably many more looking on and watching.
Yeah. So let's take a little stroll, because I think we could, if we take a stroll down the nave, we're heading, obviously, up towards the high altar here. And who officiated? Obviously, you said that it was a monastery at the time. We're pre-Reformation at the time. So was it the prior, or did somebody else come and officiate at the ceremony?
Well, certainly the prior and many other heads of monasteries would have attended and been as part of the ceremony, but the principal clergyman would have been the Bishop of Lincoln, William Smith, and he would have been helped by any other senior bishops who were able to attend.
And so we've diverted slightly away from sort of the main pathway up towards into the choir. Can we go up the steps here?
Yes, certainly.
Do you want to describe a little bit about what we can see, David?
So we're now leaving the nave and heading up into the choir area, and it's a Victorian construction with huge golden pillars going through into a painted choir with the ceiling, which was repainted by the Victorians with images of saints and Old Testament figures and Christian martyrs. And then we've got the wooden choir stalls with misericords from the 14th century that the monks would have sat on and would have been singing in when the procession and the coffin came right up where we're walking.
Right where we're walking. I mean, we're literally walking in the footsteps. You can imagine all those. How many candles did you say there were?
Several hundred.
Several hundred candles purchased. Burning. It must have been so atmospheric.
Oh.
What do you call this area right in front of the high altar? Is this also part of the choir?
Or this does is it all has, part of the choir, yes.
This is all part of the choir, and we're approaching the tomb of King John. And I can't... I know we're here to talk about Arthur, but maybe for a moment we could just talk about the tomb of John, King of England. How did he come to be here?
He was very interested in St. Wulfstan and St. Oswald, who were... whose shrines were here, and they were two Anglo-Saxon saints, and they're actually depicted in miniature on his tomb. And his favourite hunting grounds were in Worcestershire, so he visited Worcester on many occasions and spent one of his Christmases here.
Okay, and so did he specifically ask to be buried here at Worcester?
Yes, in his will.
I see. And I'm always, we'll talk about this with one of our other guides in a moment when we talk about the Chantry Chapel, but I'm always fascinated about where the body is buried, whether it's in the chest tomb or underground. And I know that this tomb was opened, wasn't it, in the 1700s. I love these stories. Can you tell us a little about the story? Because it seems like it's a complete free-for-all when they open royal tombs.
It was. So in the late 18th century, there was a plan to move King John to the Lady Chapel and by the clergy of the cathedral, and an antiquarian called Valentine Green said, I will prove to you that King John really is in his tomb, and if I can prove him, will you promise not to move the effigy? And so they agreed, and he had some workmen help him to investigate the body, and what they found was the body was indeed in the tomb.
It's actually in the chest itself, which is because it's a chest tomb, isn't it, with his effigy on top.
It might be slightly lower in the ground, but yes, it's certainly in there.
Okay.
And unfortunately, the workmen who were helping do a lot of the heavy lifting decided to take a few souvenirs of their day's hard labour. And so they took a bit of his... part of his thumb bone and part of his clothing and part of his shroud and a tip of one shoe as souvenirs. And these weren't returned to the cathedral till the 1950s or 60s by their descendants. But they allowed all the public to come and watch the funeral. And so it all got out of hand, and the crowds were getting bigger and bigger. And eventually they had to finish their investigations early because it was just too... disorganised.
Yeah. There's a very similar story with the tomb of Edward IV in St George's Chapel. It was a complete free-for-all, really? And parts of his bones are scattered now all over the country in various little memorial jewellery and the like. But it's a fascinating story. But you have those relics, don't you? You said they were returned and you can...
They were.
Are here in the library.
They are, so we have them on display.
It's quite amazing to see as well. So anyway, we do digress, but I couldn't help myself. Aren't there a couple of other interesting stories about the effigy itself and what it depicts with John? I'm thinking his sword.
His sword is shown being bitten by a lion at the base by his feet, which his feet are resting on. And some historians have come up with ideas what it might represent. But there is actually no...
Oh, come on, share.
Well, one possibility is that there was a rebellion going on in the time he died, that perhaps this is a representation of England or the barons
taking his power.
Yes, and then sort of snatching at his sword.
Right.
Representation of that.
Yeah, wonderful. Great story. So at this point, dear listeners, I want to introduce you to another of our guides today. Chris, hello, welcome.
Thank you very much indeed.
It's lovely to have you here. Would you just like to introduce yourself and say what you do here at the cathedral?
Yeah, my name's Chris Gate. I'm a cathedral guide and a general guide, a blue badge guide for the Heart of England. Retired now, so I don't do much general guiding, but love to take people around the cathedral, show them the joys and the little bits of it. And just like to add a small amount about King John and the reason for his sword that David has mentioned there. King John was the youngest of Henry II's children, and he was called Lacklands because all of the lands had been given off to the other children. And he was also called Soft Sword. He wasn't a very well liked king, although he was a very good administrator. He wasn't very well liked. He was called Soft Sword because he was not very good in battle compared to his elder brother, Richard the Lionheart, who was obviously well-loved in the country. And so one of the theories about the sword being bitten by the lion is reference to him being called Soft Sword.
I see. I love all these theories. It's brilliant.
Yes,
so,
another one.
Another one. I get the feeling there's more than even that, but I think we should probably return to the subject of the podcast and come back to poor old Prince Arthur. We've reached, obviously, we're standing just in front of the high altar here, prime position. Obviously, this is where most of the high ceremony would have taken place for the funeral. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, certainly. So that we have to imagine there would have been 40 or 50 monks in the choir stalls very close by us singing the funeral service with the bishops and abbots all assembled around the tomb and the banner bearers from the prince's cortege lined up beside them. And then as the hearse was brought in, there was also one of the king's, the Prince Arthur's retainers came with his horse and his poleaxe and in his, some of his armour, and that was presented formally at the tomb itself.
Wow.
And then at the end of the funeral, the household senior servants of Prince Arthur would have broken their staffs of office, sort of showing that their time is over, and then cast those down into the grave, rather like when Queen Elizabeth II died. And so that would have been the sort of this mark that this is the final thing.
Well, I didn't know about the horseman. That's incredible. Is that quite unusual, do you know? I'm trying to think of, I've heard of it at coronation banquets with the mounted horseman.
Of course.
That was part of the normal ceremonial. I'm not sure I've heard of it in relation to a funeral before, so interesting.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. And you have to also imagine that there'll be two golden shrines very close to King John's tomb, one for St. Oswald and one for St. Wolfstan. So you've got the sort of the gold shining with all the torches, and it would have looked very, very spectacular at the time.
Absolutely spectacular. Now, I do understand that you had a recreation of the whole service. When was that?
That was back in 2002, and they got a team of historians and experts and the College of Heraldry and advised them. And so they brought in some replica armour, specifically of Prince Arthur, and they had many of the local people dressed up as monks.
Really?
And all sorts of other costumed characters, soldiers and noblemen, and they brought them all in through the city, and they filmed the whole ceremony right into the cathedral, and then they recreated a medieval funeral in the cathedral. As much as they could.
I always miss these great events. That must have been amazing. Horsemen and all?
Horsemen and all. It was a very, very...
Were you here?
Yeah, I was. It was an amazing event to be at.
So with the staves being cast into the grave, that's really the end of the ceremony, isn't it? And it's time for the actual burial.
That's right.
So I think we're probably done here anyway. We're going to go on and talk about the Chantry Chapel, which just lies in front of me over to my right there, and explore that in some detail with one of our other expert guests today. But I think all that remains for me to say is thank you so much for being our guide so far, David.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me.
Oh.
leaves us to move on to the second part of our recording here today. And that, as I said, is to explore Arthur's Chantry Chapel, which is possibly one of the most beautiful and certainly one of the most significant chantry chapels from a Tudor history perspective. I know there are loads of you out there who love to come to Worcester or have your eye on coming to Worcester just specifically to see this chapel. So I'm looking forward to hearing all about the history of the chapel and actually Arthur's final resting place. And it's going to be back to Chris to tell us about that and to be our guide.
Okay.
Thank you for doing that.
Well, thanks so much, Sarah. Should we walk up the...
I think let's get closer. And it's got a number of different angles you can explore this chantry chapel from, haven't you? There's a side by the high altar, but the other side is equally fascinating as well. Where should we start, Chris?
Well, we'll start at the very well-worn steps of the chantry, as you can see in front of you. And it's a very grand chantry in the Perpendicular style. Probably the most interesting side is the south side with all the emblems and the pageantry of the Tudor period and the symbols of what Arthur was and his family and his father. Very important. But actually, when you look at the entrance, the rather nice curved arch, the ogee arches, typical of the time, and the perpendicular architecture, rather like the north door of the cathedral, which basically takes your eye up to God, makes you feel quite small
yes,
and irrelevant, which was the whole point of it. So, should we go into the chapel after you?
Now, this worn step tells stories, doesn't it, of hundreds of years of people stepping exactly where we're stepping. And I believe one of those was Elizabeth the First.
Yes.
So she visited Worcester 1575.
Yes, one of her visit, major visit here, and she would have come to see her very important relatives there, who died, as we know, very early, with so much hope for the Tudor period. That's why he's named Arthur, to regain that Arthurian legend, because his father, Henry the Seventh, had very, very sort of dubious hold on the crown. And his premature death, we were talking about it a little bit earlier, of the sweating sickness that went through Ludlow and the area at the time. Ironically brought in by his father's troops, Henry VII's troops at Milford Haven. But a modern twist on it is that the sweating sickness was thought to be a hantavirus, a respiratory virus that was, in Arthur's case, he was merry at dinner and dead at supper. So it happened very, very quickly. The disease took place many places in the world. Piketty disease affected Chinese labourers in San Francisco. But more recently, they think that Gene Hackman's wife, Betsy Arakama, died of it, the sweats, the hantavirus. I don't think the autopsy has been done yet. That's why she died so suddenly and couldn't look after Gene Hackman.
It's really interesting, tragic but interesting connection that connects past to present, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we've come inside the Chantry Chapel. I think it'd be lovely to start with just as much description. Now, this is a good place for me just to remind you, as ever, dear listeners, there's a show notes page where I'll be including images of the things that we're talking about here. So if you want a visual representation to go along with this audio, then head on over via the link, which will be included in the description associated with this podcast. But for now, perhaps you could try and capture in words the stunning sight that we see before us.
Well, so it's just a beautiful chantry in the Perpendicular style. The tomb of Arthur is relatively plain for such an important Prince of Wales, say with the hope of the nation in front of us, relatively plain, with a plain emblem of England, and still the slight claim to France, as you see with the fleur-de-lis there at the time. Lots of sculptures of saints, before and after, and the beautiful, beautiful, what's called Lian vaulting with those pendants coming down. Absolutely gorgeous. You have to crook your neck to see it a little bit. It would have been intended to be decorated quite grandly, but perhaps when Arthur's elder brother took over Henry VIII, he lost interest in decorating this a little bit. Some of the sculptures have been defaced that you see on the east side, and that may be due to the iconoclasm when Edward VI came to the throne. We became more of a Protestant country, very much in the Protestant faith. And as we mentioned before, the death of Arthur was one of those great possibly what-ifs happened in history. They were probably defaced, these sculptures, by troops during the Civil War. A lot of troops were garrisoned here, and the only place you could put 3,000 or 4,000 troops, and they'd be drinking and knocking heads off of various things.
Yes, because if you look at the statue, you can see the kind of the hacking, can't you? I presume this is like blade, literally the stone has been hacked at.
Yes, with their swords taking chunks off, and you can see these vertical parts here, literally just chiselled away.
Yeah.
Bored soldiers.
Yeah, nothing better to do. Yeah. I've got a couple of questions. I read a paper about this Chantry Chapel because I'm a bit fascinated by it. And it said that it was created off-site and brought in to be constructed. And actually, there was a bit of a mess made of the dimensions.
Yes.
Somebody made a bit of a faux pas, yes, shall we say. Can you tell us a bit more about that? Because I think it's an interesting story.
Well, we think that it was made off-site, rather like an IKEA chapel built, moved in, and not built for purpose. And if you have a look at the tomb is not quite symmetrical.
Mm-hmm.
The north side is a bit wider than the south side, which if it was built to purpose, you'd expect it to be completely symmetrical. It has a squint on the southeast side, which we'll walk on through to have a look. Which seems to go nowhere. Seems to go nowhere. Where squints were to give an idea to people, when, the idea of a chantry was to say prayers for the dead in perpetuity. That was what the money was paid for. And the squint would be to give an idea of when the service was going to be to the monks, and it seems to go nowhere.
It just looks down the one of the aisles, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yeah,
it's not looking towards any other altar
anything.
Or the high altar that you might expect it to.
So we think that it was built for somebody else, the chantry, possibly lots of different stories, possibly Henry VII, who would have wanted a big chantry for himself, possibly somebody else. And the thought may be that Arthur wasn't intended to be buried here permanently. He would be buried here initially because it was convenience, the closest of the royal cathedrals, and then be moved to St George's Chapel in Windsor or to Westminster Abbey. But when we have a look, it is slightly asymmetrical, and when we look at the south side and the emblems, you'll see that it's all been tagged in to fit around rather than...
A bit of a botched job, you know.
And even we're not certain this was the original place of the church. It might have been moved within the cathedral itself there.
Right.
To get prominent position here.
One of the other things, you touched on it, is how plain the tomb is. Do we know if there was ever intended to be an effigy of Arthur? Any record of that anywhere?
Not that we're aware that if there had been intended to be an effigy, but say perhaps his elder brother lost interest in Arthur during the Reformation and that period. But as we think, it's just a plain tomb Not as grand, obviously, as King John's tomb.
Mm. And there's some writing around the side, which is really faded now.
Yes, yeah.
What does it say?
Well, it would be saying that our prince departed out of the world at a certain period, too early.
Oh, Chris is walking around the tomb.
All the way around.
Ah, departed this life too early.
And essentially, a little story of the death, and not why he's here, but the transportation from Ludlow.
Oh, right, OK. That's wonderful. The other question, I mentioned it with King John, I'm always fascinated with, is where is his body? Is it in there? Is it in a vault?
We think it is where you're standing
now. Oh, how exciting.
There's a small altar on the east side of the chantry.
Yes.
And we think he's actually buried there, and the rather plain tomb was just added on the top.
So I've researched quite a lot of Tudor tombs, and what I found is, in most instances, the actual body is buried in a vault rather than in the chest tomb. So we've got a vault here. And I also think I read in one of those papers that there had been some kind of geophys survey, and it's quite a big vault, I understand.
Apparently, it is a double vault, possibly intended for a Catherine of Aragon to be buried there, because she was affected by the sweats a little bit at Ludlow, survived, but may well be that there's a double vault if she did succumb.
Yeah.
They'd be buried together.
But it's obviously never been opened.
Not that we're aware.
Okay. So before we go, is there any other symbolism or any other features in the Chantry Chapel that we need to take note of?
A little bit would be the painting of the centre sculpture on the east end here, which would be clean. You see little bits of it in the other sculptures that have been cleaned off over the years and removed in the iconoclastic period.
And outside, you mentioned previously, there's loads of heraldry. I'd love to go and have a look at that, because I think that's fascinating when you walk outside the chapel and look at it from the outside. Is that the north side, I think,
yes,
you mentioned?
Yes.
Yeah, can we go and have a look?
The south side.
Oh, it's the south side. Beg your
sunny
pardon.
Side.
The sunny side. Could we go and have a look at some of those, and maybe you can decode them for us? Right, so we're here on the... We've come outside the Chantry Chapel, around the corner, and down these stairs, and you're faced with this towering edifice, which for me is much more spectacular than the other side. And one of the wonderful things is this array of Tudor symbolism and heraldry. And it's fun to be able to decode and think, oh, that's that, that's that, that's that. So maybe we could go through each of them and just look at some of the symbols and the heraldry that's on display here. And what does that say about Arthur?
Mm. Well, I say there are 19 symbols in total, and they're very, very grand. And they're above two tombs of Bishop Gifford and his sister Matilda. Another indication, in fact, that the tomb was, the chantry was not intended to be here. It was all added on and bits taken away. But above the tombs, say, are these wonderful, wonderful heraldry. And there is a legend there for any visitor to
tell us about the legend. Tell you which is which. I see, yes.
So any visitor doesn't have to remember all of them, which I probably won't be able to. but they are symbols of Tudor, York, Tudor portcullises, Castile and Aragon. Yes. Of the families of Catherine as well. We'll take you through a few of them. On the far left one is the rose of Lancaster, the red rose, with the two fletches above, which indicates we haven't given up hope of reclaiming France.
Right.
We have the Tudor rose here,
yes,
which would be the red rose on the outside of Lancaster, and the white rose, dominant one of York, in the centre.
Yeah.
You have a portcullis.
The Beaufort portcullis.
Beaufort portcullis, which is now the emblem of Parliament.
Yes.
With the feather on the top there. Further along, you have a flesh of arrows, which is from Catherine's father of Aragon.
And we've also got here the Fetterlock and Falcon, which is the Yorkist.
Yes.
The Yorkist emblem. Unfortunately, the falcon's missing his head, but...
Another bit removed.
And then clearly we've got the royal coat of arms, I would imagine, right?
Yes.
In the middle there.
Another portcullis here with the Tudor rose on top. Further along, very much symbols of the pomegranate from Granada.
Yes, Catherine's
home city.
Yes.
Although she's Catherine of Aragon from her father's empire, she was actually brought up in Granada, which was both Ferdinand and Isabella, her parents, managed to rescue Granada from the Moors, push them out. So that's the symbol. And it's also a symbol of fertility, that if you open a pomegranate, seeds flow out. So it's a symbol of fertility.
It's interesting, because often when you see Catherine's symbol, it is slashed and you see the seeds, but this one is actually complete.
Intact.
And I don't know, I wonder whether that's because they haven't had children yet.
Or whether the marriage was not consummated.
Well, yes.
But we open another
Henry
can of
VIII
worms.
Would have something to say about that, wouldn't
yes, he worked it both ways.
And I think the other final thing here is just the garter, clearly,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, the garter. He was Knight of the Garter, Oniswaki Malipontz, evil is who evil thinks. He was a Knight of the Garter, and that was proposed by Edward I, Order's ancestors.
I'm getting a crick neck. I mean, it really does tower above you. It's absolutely spectacular.
Absolutely splendid, with all of the symbolism as Prince of Wales, Knight of the Garter, the family connections from both his father and his Catherine's side, and also his mother, Elizabeth of York, who Henry Tudor, Henry VII, married to reunite the country after the dreadful Wars of the Roses.
Yeah.
Before we leave the chantry, when you look up, you see the pinnacles, and an indication really on the east and west pinnacles that have been cut down to fit in, which indicates that it came from somewhere else.
Yeah.
And the general asymmetry of the whole thing, even the heraldry, the carvings, aren't centralised. They're all squidged in a little bit.
Yeah.
So they would, if they were cut for purpose, they would be absolutely perfect. Centralised.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah.
So it has been moved from somewhere else. Where is it? Another story.
Yeah, I think those pinnacles and the way the kind of the arches have been hacked and the pinnacles have been hacked are probably the best indicators that you can see that it's just it's a bit of a botched job, basically. But nevertheless, beautiful one. I'd be quite happy
stunning.
With that.
Yes, you could stand here and look at the beauty of it all and the symbols that are there.
And when the sun shines through that window, the window that's just over to my right here, it shines directly onto this white stone, and it just the whole thing just lights up. It's rather beautiful. Now, before we finish, there is a tomb over to my right-hand side, and I can see the label on the tomb, so Griffith Rees, and I know that this chap has something to do with Arthur, so perhaps you could tell us a little bit about him.
Well, this is a tomb and rather a grand tomb compared to Arthur that has been rebrassed in the 19th century, 1870 odds. And this is of Sir Griffith Rees, and he was a member of Arthur's household and, in fact, carried Arthur's coat of arms and emblems during the procession there,
right.
So very important there.
Yeah, right.
But say, rather a grander tomb, rather nice brass work, we think by Hardiman in the 1870s and part of the Victorian Restoration there.
Yeah, it's beautiful though. At least you can properly read it, which is great. I wonder why he ended up in Worcester. I mean, was he still? Did he carry on living here? Did he want to be close to Arthur? Do we have any idea about why here?
Why he was here? I don't think we really know. But he died virtually 21 years later, and probably requested to be buried to the person that he loved the most and was devoted to.
Oh, that's such a lovely thought. That's such a lovely thought. Okay, well, I think that kind of brings us to the end. Perhaps it would be useful if you could let people know anything about the visiting hours here at the cathedral, anything that they need to know.
Oh.
And just as I speak, the sun's coming out and starting to illuminate the Chantry Chapel.
Yeah, the cathedral is open virtually every day from 10 o'clock till 4 last. You can walk around the cathedral. Quite openly. There is a brief service on the hour, every hour, so it is still a working cathedral. So if visitors could just respect that service, only lasts for a couple of minutes by visiting a preacher there. There are plenty of tours, which we encourage everybody to take, obviously. You can turn up for a tour at 11 in the morning and 2:30 in the afternoon. You don't have to book, and a very experienced guide will take you around. There are also theme tours of stained glass, women's monuments, tours up the tower, which are fascinating to look at Worcester and the area from the 60 feet up. Oh, you must do it. And of course, Worcester was the first and the last parts of the Civil War, the first and the last battles in the Civil War took place in Worcester. And if you go to the top of the tower, we can do a tour on the Civil War and the Battle of Worcester.
And you do have, very close to the cathedral, there's a rather charming street with a couple of beautiful Tudor timber-framed houses, including, I think it's Greyfriars?
Greyfriars, yeah.
Owned by the National Trust, and that's a lovely example of a Tudor sort of merchant's house.
Yes.
So there are other historic parts of Worcester to enjoy.
There are plenty of things in Worcester. You can spend days and days here.
What's your favourite other thing other than coming to the cathedral, Chris? From a historic point of view.
From a historic point of view, for me, the most important thing would be the Porcelain Museum. Museum.
Of course, Royal Worcester.
Royal Worcester porcelain, founded by a doctor, actually, a very eminent doctor who is a very good artist as well, in the 1700s, started porcelain manufacturing here, and then that was taken on by Royal Worcester. The museum there is absolutely fascinating, and you could spend a whole day there.
Really? Oh, I haven't done that either.
I know.
This feels like there's a lot of Worcester still to explore.
Unfortunately, the factory is closed. Royal Worcester is gone, whereas previously you could buy seconds goods there, but now that's all gone. Okay.
Well, just before we go, if you could allow me to just say to you guys listening, tuning in, that I mentioned this earlier on, but in July next year, that's 2026, I will be co-hosting a tour called 1502, the year that shook the Tudor throne. And in fact, we are going to be following the footsteps of Henry VII and Elizabeth of York during their summer progress from Woodstock down to Raglan Castle and back again. But the first part of the tour, the first day, we're actually coming here to Worcester to see the Chantry Chapel, because, of course, so much of what happened in 1502, and particularly around the 1502 summer progress, was on the back of some of the grief and despair that the royal couple felt from losing their eldest son in April that year. And we're going to be exploring all the events around Arthur's death and burial and how that set up what happened later during the year. And ultimately, of course, which culminated in the death of Elizabeth of York in February 1503. So if you would love to come and see this for yourself and join me, then do check out the link in the description associated with this podcast, where you'll see all the other links, including one to check out Worcester Cathedral and the events and opening times, etc. Okay, well, I think that just remains for me to say thank you so much, Chris, for being our guide on the second half of the podcast today.
My pleasure.
Well, that's it, my friends. We are complete, and I do hope you enjoyed this second episode in this two-part feature. And of course, it's a massive thank you to our expert guests today, David Morrison and Chris Gate, who did a sterling job of showing us around the cathedral. I do hope you will get to visit. It is a wonderful place. And if you love tombs, if you're a taphophile like I am, wow. There's so much to capture your interest, not least, of course, Arthur's tomb. Well, I will be returning next month when I will be actually visiting the birthplace of Anne Boleyn, or the assumed birthplace of Anne Boleyn, Blickling Hall in Norfolk. I'm excited to go over there. In fact, I'm just about in the next day or so ready to pack my bags to head off to Norfolk to do some recording, not only at Blickling, but in Norwich, to capture another couple of episodes that will be coming your way in the future. Until the next time. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling!